from stpetecatalyst.com.
Macaulay Culkin, and I was like, oh, okay, that's, I want to do that. And so that's where things changed.
So that's where you say, I'm going to have to actually study and learn things about this.
I mean, maybe not study. It was just like, I want to, well, I didn't know at that time. So it was just like, I want to do that. So my mom was like, okay, we're going to put you in dance class. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I was like, ooh, this is what it feels like to, and then, but then I was like more excited about it. And then I auditioned for Harrison, and that was a very interesting time. High school was actually, like, some people are like, high school is the best part of your life. And I was like, high school was horrible.
Where is Harrison? Where is that?
Harrison's in Lakeland.
Oh.
And I mean, it was a lot of growing. It was a lot of doing this, trying this, and then like not doing that, and, you know, learning how to partner. Your body's changing. Your hormones are changing. You're dealing with people from everywhere. You're trying to figure out what it's like, because my studio had done theater a certain way. And so now you're at this place where they teach theater. And so now you're having to figure out like all of these new things on like how a production's supposed to happen. And people have their ways in which, you know, they teach that. And so it was great and eye-opening. But then it was also like the beginning of me being pushed into, you don't have the body or the physique or these things to do ballet, so you should do modern. And you should do modern because Alvin Ailey does modern. So like these things would be great. I started getting a lot of, and not necessarily from teachers per se, but people that you see, people that are watching you, like that stuff starts to affect you after a while. It's like, yes, I am a black queer dancer. Well, and at that time I didn't know it was queer. But you know, like I'm a black queer artist. Like I'm moving, and I'm now getting linked to dancing in this all black space, which is great. But like, but why do I have to dance there? Mm. And a little bit of that also happened it happened at USF too, you know, during my time there. It was like, okay, so you're done. So like, you really should audition for Alien. It's like, nah, I don't want to audition for Alien. Like I love Alien. I love what it does. I've never taken a Horton class, but I was never into that. So when I got into the Lines program, that was huge. Mm-hmm. Especially because it was like, I was told, you're not a dancer. And then to get, or you're not, it's not that I'm not a dancer, you're not a ballet dancer.
Yeah.
But then when you get into a program that's focused primarily in ballet, you're just like, oh, well, I mean, I guess I can be, you know? And then like, how does that change you? And what's crazy is that ballet's always been, when I went to Paris in January, I went and I took a ballet class. Like that was the first thing, like I got there and there was a ballet teacher that I'd met in Berlin the summer prior. And I was gonna go take class with her and like have dinner with her because she lives in Paris. And then I was going to, and then she was like, one of my pupils is teaching ballet for, and at that time I didn't know it was USF, but I found out. I was like, oh, that's cool. So she was like, you should go take their class. And I was like, great. I was like, is she teaching ballet? And I was like, oh, cool. So ballet is kind of, I have a weird tension with ballet because it's not something that I fit into, and yet I do it. So
is it something that you have to learn in order to sort of, I don't know, free your body a certain way, like to learn these way of standing and the way of moving? See, I don't move very well. This is all stuff I don't completely understand. Do you have to learn ballet to be a modern dancer?
No. I mean, no. So there's a school of thought that like ballet is the center of like ballet. Like if you learn ballet, then you can do any style. And I challenge that.
Okay.
And I challenge that because like African dancers, they don't learn ballet and yet they do African, but then they can also potentially do hip hop and then, you know, they can do jazz. I don't think that ballet is necessarily the center of all dance. I think that's a very white European way of like looking at dance.
And, oh, granted, you're probably, you know, right.
Like it doesn't, I think I learned both, but like I actually came up, I actually, if we want to be real about it, or like go back to like trace it back to where it starts, I learned from Janet, you know what I mean? How to dance and put steps together. And then I learned different ways of accenting those steps through jazz. And then I learned, you know, ballon and effacé and all of these other things and all these body positions from ballet. And then I learned how to ground, but then also a lot of those terms for those other styles were kind of in my body from naturally moving and mimicking. And like that play that happened at a very early age from like watching somebody and then trying to imitate what they're doing.
Imbues who you are. Oh yeah. I totally understand that. I mean, I'm an amateur musician, but a lot of what I learned early on is still up here, you know, mm-hmm. It still comes out in the fingers, you know. What happened when you got to UF? What was that like?
USF was...
USF, that's what I meant, yes.
Gretchen, I remember Gretchen's class so well because I came to USF and I was a transfer student. And I remember I was in her class, she's teaching Chiketty, and Chiketty has it's a very different way. Like Baganova is a little bit more lengthened, it's Russian technique. Chiketty to me, and this is, you know, I'm speaking for myself and how it feels in my body, it is a little bit smaller. And I'm a long person, so I didn't want to, you know, be small. And I remember Gretchen looking at me, she goes, you're not in San Francisco anymore. You're not at Lines. You're at USF. And I remember that like hurt me the first day. And then I was like, wait, but I'm not there. Like I can actually come into this stuff a little differently. USF was crazy because I went so many places. I actually came out, as gay when I was on a trip with Jeannie Travers. We got invited to go to perform in Tunisia.
Yeah.
And so we're spending 10 days in Monastir, and I had my journal and I was like, Jeannie, I'm going to take a break one day. And we were in a class and I was like, I'm not coming to class. And I remember I got a Coke, sat at this bar, the ocean is like right there. And I just journaled. And then I like journaled it out and I was like, oh wow. Like this is it. And then it was interesting to come back from that trip and into Bill T. Jones's process with Serenade the Proposition, mm-hmm. for more like self-discovery of like, now, how do you fit, you know, how do you fit in this moment in time? And that piece was about Abraham Lincoln. And so how do you fit in this moment in time? And then also how do you maybe fit in history? Like how do your ancestors, how are they a part of you? What is that? And so it was kind of like, I don't know. It felt like it was the thing that I needed. USF was, it was a great time. I learned a lot, there.
Well, I mean, don't you have to in school? I mean, don't you have to learn how to, on simplest level, you know, play well with others? I mean, there's discipline, I suppose, that one learns in school. And this is where you met Andy Scott, who I think had a great impression on you.
Yes, she did. Yeah. So Andy was a visiting teacher at the time, and I, and Lynn Wimmer was leaving. And actually, it's interesting that you say discipline, because Andy taught me to be undisciplined.
Great. Okay.
And I mean, like, maybe not taught, but like, she was the example of not being disciplined, right? And, you know, in recent talks, like Andy and I, we've talked about like, you know, being people of color, making work, especially in predominantly white spaces. What is that? And she is, you know, a person in the community that, you know, besides my favorite Bob Devin Jones, but like, she's a person that I look up in the community as like somebody who looks at these rules and she goes, okay, this is what people are doing, or this is what people are doing. These are the choices that they're making. And I'm going to make this choice. I remember a day I got into a fight with my best friend, and we walked into Andy's class. And at that time, Andy was starting her class with like everybody laying on the ground. And she would say, okay, and arrive, we're going to arrive. And I remember getting into class and I was upset with my friend and I'm laying there and I'm mad. before Andy could start, oh, Andy goes, okay, everybody arrive. And I go, I'm not arriving. And I just got up and I left. And she goes, okay. And that was, it was a moment, right, where like.
A plus.
Kind of, well, maybe not A plus, but it's just, you know, I think about if I were to do that, like in another situation, right, this idea of discipline and like doing the things that people are telling you, or the idea of like falling in line. If I were to fall in line my whole life, I don't know if, and that wasn't like a pivotal moment with Andy, but it was just, there was something there where it was like, yo, I have agency. Like I have agency to like make a choice. Like if in this moment, I am not able to arrive in my body, then I'm just not going to arrive. And that's something like, even in grad school, we talk about like, and when I'm working with the company, I'm not interested in, when I'm working with the artists, I'm not interested in them making forced choices. So if I, every prompt that I'm giving them, or even the prompts that were given in grad school, I'm taking them as suggestions. I don't necessarily have to do them. Even in writing a thesis, right? You're writing this thesis, they're like, you know, it, use this language, do this, do that. And I'm like, okay, I could say intersectionality, or I could just show you what intersectionality means. And I can show you how I navigate systematic oppression. And I can show you what multiplicity looks like. Like, I can show you what that is rather than just regurgitating information. Because, yeah, that's, again, it's a form of mimicry. But, I mean, ultimately, what's that doing for me and what's it doing for you? I feel like there's a moment where you start to put things in practice and that, like, changes things up.
But you have to, you know, I'm going back to discipline, you know, maybe that wasn't the exact word, but I mean, you have to sort of know, otherwise it becomes like arrhythmia, right? It becomes like there's, you know, form. I think we're talking about form here, you know, like a formless thing. Tell me about Collective Soul and Souls, which is the first company that you had, I guess, 2016.
Oh, yeah.
What were you trying to do there?
So that actually wasn't my baby. So Troy Jansen started that company, and I was at a period where I was in transition, Troy was in transition, and at the time, Audrey Richter was working for the company as the youth ensemble director. And so there was a trying to figure out who was going to take it over, and Audrey and I were in conversations about it. And she had said that she was offered, and then I said that I was interested. And so in our back and forth, she was like, okay, well, you know, if you feel comfortable, like go and talk to him about it. So I did. And I talked to Troy about it, and then I ended up becoming the artistic director. And Collective Souls was like a huge learn curve for me. Because I learned how to run an organization, like the do's and don'ts of running an organization. And then also like the do's and don'ts, if you had to put it on paper, of running an organization, but then also like, what are my do's and don'ts? What am I interested in? And so I tried to do things really, really structured. And in some ways I got rid of some structure. Mm-hmm. And I tried some different things with performances. Like that's where I actually didn't know if I wanted to do a nonprofit situation. And that's where I fell in love with like the idea of like nonprofit and community. And that was before I started actually questioning like what a community is, like what does it look like? How is it formed? But I was excited about like, okay, this idea of giving back, and now I can get people integrated. So like one of the last shows that we did was a project that I wanted to continue called the Collab Series, where we would collaborate with a bunch of, the idea was that the series would continue every year. We would collaborate with a bunch of different artists in some way to make a piece. And so that was collaborating with USF, University of Tampa, and Manatee School for the Arts, and then some students from the Collective Souls Youth Program. And I wanted it to do it that way because I hadn't seen anything yet where like a choreographer or an artist had brought the schools together in that way. Like the UT, I work at UT, and I, you know, sometimes guest and or work with the students at USF. but the universities work separate. So there's never a moment where like the universities come together for this big like thing. So then I was like, okay, then what if we are? Like, instead of trying to ask somebody to do it, what if you just do it? And that's kind of, that's actually been something as an artist, that's, if I had a mantra, maybe that's what it, one of them is that like, instead of me asking for you, like, hey, can you do this thing to help us out to do this? It's like, I'm just going to do it. Like, no, I'm not going to,
yeah,
I'm not gonna wait to ask you because I'd be waiting forever because you may not want to do it. If it's something that I truly want to do, then I'll do it.
Well, in office politics, that translates as, you know, don't ask permission, but ask forgiveness later if you have to. How did that become Project Alchemy, or did it not? I mean, is there a very large dividing line between the two companies?
So I left Collective Souls, and a little bit of me needed a little bit of a break, to be honest. But then also, I was going into grad school, and so everything kind of teetered off at a point. And so I was on a plane going to LA with my husband to see in-laws. Mm-hmm. And on that trip, I ended up kind of writing and journaling. I was reading The Alchemist. And there's something about it about, oh man, I just quoted this like a long time ago. But it was kind of, the idea that like when you're young, you have this idea. You have this idea, you have this dream, and then when you grow up, the dream goes away because you have all of this other outside knowledge that kind of takes up. So then you kind of spend your, the thought or the theory is that you spend your entire life trying to get back to that thing.
Right.
And I had already said when I was very young that I wanted a company to run. Like I wanted, that's what I wanted. And so then I was like, well, then why don't you just do it? And then I was like, oh, okay. And then alchemy, right? Alchemy is this magical, you know, combination of creation, I inserted collaboration, or it's combination, mm-hmm. and transformation. And so then I was like, oh, then that's what it is. And a lot of people were like, oh my gosh, you're gonna have a company, then you should call it Alex Jones or Jones Works or something. And I was like, I don't want to put my name on it. Because then it feels, I look at Project Alchemy as like a legacy. So when I die, because one day it's gonna happen, you know, the company continues to live, and it actually can continue to live and transform and create and collaborate. Like the vision of my vision will be there, but somebody else can run with that vision and go and do something with it. Like that's kind of what it is. That's
sure.
meant to be.
It's collaboration meant, is a chain, you know, it just yeah. keeps going.
Well, it's meant to outlive me. And right. so I don't want to put my name on it because then it seems like everything that's created in it is like an Alex Jones, and that's, I didn't know if I wanted that.
I want to look at a photograph here if I can find it. Give me a second. Because I think this is a Project Alchemy thing. And I believe you can't see it yet, can you? I'm still trying to figure this out. This okay. is okay, Bill, where's the picture? Keep talking, Alex. I'm embarrassing myself here.
Oh, it's fine.
I can't find the stupid picture, so go ahead.
What would you like to know?
Collaboration. I have a few notes, and that's one I wrote down, and I'll figure that thing out later. But the idea that dance is an exchange. Mm-hmm. Again, for me, I when I talk to dancers, Helen's been on here. And I always try to ask people to explain how it works for them, and it's a language, you know, but it's also it can be an exchange between two people or more people. What do you think dance is? I mean, is it you're bursting with energy? I can see it coming out of your eyes and your fingertips, you know. So do you think of it as the way you talk to people, the way you interact with people?
Yes. Dance is everything untrained and trained. And because dance is so like, right. Like the question, what is dance is kind of, it's a broad question because it's like, well,
it's a very broad question. You see, I wrangled it in from something really big and brought it in a little bit. Yeah.
But it's like, what are you talking about? Like, we took a class in Berlin with Michael Schumacher. Mm-hmm. It was all about instant improvisation into instant composition. So like everything that you just did with your hands, the way that you just shifted your neck, like that's instant composition. Mm. Like that could actually be something that's exaggerated.
This is a physical language.
Like my hand can be exaggerated. So like that is a part of dance. And then you have your codified situations, you know, which, you know, it's a way of, it's also a language. And in some ways it's a way of taking the person who like created that language and like making sure that their legacy stays alive through the people doing the movement. Right. Mm-hmm. So like Horton stays alive because, you know, Lester Horton created it, and now his movements are now embodied in all of us. Just like, you know, you go and take a Pilates class, the man who made Pilates, like it's a language. And like, even Pilates is dance, yoga is dance. Right. So, people walking down the street, Andy made a very interesting, observation about like thinking about right now, people are walking and we have to social distance. So if you're walking down the street, let's say we're walking down the street towards each other, we're walking like this, and then we get pretty close, boom, we move. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know. One of my favorite things is to people watch, just to see, or like, I'm a huge hockey fan. I went to my first hockey game maybe like 3 years ago. And I love watching hockey from like the top, because you literally see people coming in and out and they're spinning around and the puck is going and you're trying to find where the puck is. But like the shapes and the configurations that they're making, they're dancing.
I never thought of it that way. Sure, yeah.
And then what's also interesting is I like it more than I like, for me, football is a choreographed situation with some improvisational things put in. In the sense that, like, improvisation in the terms of you don't know what's going to happen because people can move or, you know, whatever. But the choreography of the set positions is made. And, yeah, the same could be said about hockey. But there's an interesting language of watching people come on and off the ice. And I, till this day, am so curious as to how that's communicated.
Yeah.
Like, how are they talking about who comes in and who comes out? But then also, when I'm working with the company or I've been in classes, we've done that where we're all moving and we're improvising, and then you give like the cue to move, move, move. Okay. When you're ready to stop, you stop. And then you have, or when you're ready to go outside and witness somebody moving. And then it's very interesting. Like, okay, I'm moving and now I choose to stop and I choose to watch you. We've actually, the company's even done it on Zoom where I've given prompts and mm-hmm. we've all been moving in our little squares. And then I give them the option to just take a step back and just observe what's going on, see the natural composition of what's happening.
And that will affect what the others do too, right? Well,
and then sometimes you're like, oh, this is cool, I want to jump back in, or no, I just want to be a witness.
Here we go. Tell me what we're looking at.
So that is, I'm trying to remember the exact, so this is a piece near and dear to my heart because Rebecca Lazaridis.
It's called Bloomin' Residue.
Yeah, it was a joint situation with Rebecca Lazaridis, and I know that this is a part of the second section. I think this is second section, the end of the second section, because I just set Heidi down, and I think I'm about to go to the floor. But this was an awesome collaboration, because we had talked and I was like, I would like to make a Rite of Spring, and a lot of people have made Rites of Spring.
Yeah,
it's a popular, you know, dance situation for big companies, and usually in it somebody, usually a woman, is sacrificed. And I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to create a piece about sacrifice. And my grandfather is a florist, so there's a lot of like our pants in this picture, as you see, they're petals, they're actual like of a flower with like the residue on the bottom. And I never got a chance to meet my grandfather, but my family always said that I have his florist instincts as far as like arrangement. Like that's something that I like to do like secretly on the side. And so that kind of played into this idea of like flowers, spring, blooming. But then I was thinking, and you know, Rebecca and I were in conversation about like every time something blooms, well, A, the act of blooming is like a very violent act, but also like the bloom leaves a residue. So like our conversation today is going to leave a residue. That residue will be on Facebook. It will be on the catalyst. Mm-hmm. It will be in our bodies because of the information that we've just shared. It'll be with the people who are listening right now, and they may think of things, they may comment or whatever. And so this was a dance installation where you kind of entered into this maze by the beautiful work of Rebecca. And she added her own personal touches through, you know, through her own like life experiences. And then you came into what this room was like, we kind of called it the transformation room. Mm-hmm. And so this was the moment where you're seeing like where things kind of change. And then the next room was the bloom room. So the girl on the ground on her back, that's Kirsten, our rehearsal director. And she does this beautiful solo with one light. And she ends up taking you into this bloom room. And what we invited the audience to do was to write their experience about what happened in the space and then leave it anywhere in the space for the next group of people to read it, because then it sparked something for them. So the idea was that whatever bloomed for you, write that bloom down, and that bloom now becomes residue in the space. And then it might bloom for somebody else so that they can then write residue in the space. All of these little moments of mortality, of like small deaths that are happening, and also life. But the idea that like, it's not a true death, right? It's not like your spirit is gone, it's over or anything like that. But you know, something may happen. I have a decaying tooth in my mouth right now. It's dead, right? So like its life is gone, you know? But, and so now the residue behind is the decayed tooth, you know? And what does that do? And how does that affect the rest of my mouth? And so it's, I don't know that we were actually hoping to reset that, at Beacon 20, right before everything went down in its actual entirety, because it was originally created for a black box. So we were in talks about how does that manifest on a proscenium stage? Because so I actually have weird tension with proscenium stages, just because I don't like the distance. I was actually excited to figure out, and we had made some changes to the work. We had added some people in. We had some really cool things that we were going to do with movable like platforms and things. So we were excited about creating something new. And now it's like, it's not happening now, but also what's cool is that idea bloomed, right? The new idea of what bloom and residue could be in a proscenium stage happened. And the residue is something that we will now keep until it can actually see a stage.
Sure.
So it's not that it's gone. It's just not happening right now.
We're actually in the last couple of minutes here. What I wanted to talk with you about was this idea that, and you and I have spoken about it before, that there isn't a huge dance scene in Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. And it's not even arguable whether or not there should be, because obviously there should be, but what do we do to change that? You know, the audience is just not ready. We just need more and better performance spaces. In your mind?
I think there's a couple of things. I think half of it is we have a great kids dance scene. Mm-hmm. Students can take classes at everybody's studio because everybody has a studio that you can take a place at. But if you are an artist that is in a university setting and or higher, and you're trying to make work, there's not that many spaces for you. And so there's that one. And then if there is a space for you, sometimes you get priced out of that space, or you have to know somebody to get into that space. You have to get into a space, you know what I mean? Like you have to get into a space to actually get into the space, you know what I mean? To do the work. And then I also think that it's a little bit of like, what are the opportunities, right? So we have these students that leave UT and USF and HCC. A lot of, because there's not that many opportunity, like yes. people doing things for somebody to join here. Yes. A lot of faculty are like, hey, go to New York, go here, go there. Or students go, I want to get out of here. I want to go here. I want to go there because they're doing this. I want to go. I want to go. I want to go.
Yeah, it's so an old story. Sure. Yeah.
So then not that many people are staying because there's not that much. I know for Project Alchemy, we have a company and then we have a project-based list. Mm. And that project-based list grows because I will get asked to do something. And then I ask my company first and I say, hey, can you guys do it? And then Heidi or Sophie or Carissa might be like, no, I can't. Or Fernando, you know, they're like, I can't do this. And then I start to go into the project-based list, and that happens a lot more than not. I know for me, I'm always interested in people coming and taking community class with us because that's a way for me to get to know you, because I'm not interested in auditions. For me, and I worked at Disney for 13, 14 years. I've seen the gamut of go to the audition, you give them your best 30 seconds, and then you get into that rehearsal process and it's a tragedy. And so I'm interested in, maybe if I'm able to work with you a lot through class and you can see how we're moving in the space, then yeah, I would be more apt to working with you because I've had that. Now, obviously our current situation makes that a little bit different. But even then, like I'm also seeing, Andy and I talked about this a little bit. I contracted COVID-19 not too long ago. Mm-hmm. My husband had it and then I got it. And so there's viscerally something in my body. And also when I think about very close people to me that either have COVID or that I don't want to have COVID, my 101-year-old grandmother, it makes my body do something. But then I also see this time of lockdown as like, I now have space and I have to rethink what space is and I have to rethink what performance looks like. But I have the time to make work in a completely different way and actually work with people that I've never worked with before or wanted to. I worked with Joey Clay from Joey Clay Studios on a part of my thesis. My thesis became a website that it wasn't that I wasn't expecting it to, or that it was like, oh, it was a crazy change. I was supposed to be at Holland's performing at a Black Box. And then they told us, hey, you're not going to Holland's. You're not going to Berlin this year. That's done. And I was in a process of a first draft with USF students on like, this might be material that I'm using for my thesis. They got to perform it not on stage, but in the studio at our last rehearsal. And I felt like that was better than anything. And then I kind of took that material and I put it into my thesis. And then my thesis shocked me because it was like, oh, it's the process of making a performance, and it's also me performing process all at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's all of those things. And I was like, dance actually can, what I kind of find interesting is that in this moment, I feel like, especially listening to people in my grad program, they're like, oh man, like I didn't know that dance could do this. And it's like, dance has been doing this whole time. People have been working via Zoom to create work. They've been working via online platforms to do things. They've been putting things up online. It's just now, because we don't have the physical space to be with each other, that we are now put into, you know, now we're trying to figure out and like, you know, calculate and how can we use this new form. And there was a rush to do it. And I think for me, it was kind of nice to not jump into teaching immediately and not jump into putting, you know, just dance out there, like for me to actually figure out, okay, I'm going to use this new form, but like, how do I want to use this new form? I'm a person that wants to connect with my audience in a way that makes it interactive and gets you thinking. I don't like to give all the secrets out about the performance. So how can I still do this on this platform without my body being there? How can I be a bodiless dancer? And also have my body there. It even made me question the ideas of like, is dance ephemeral? I don't think it is anymore, but I don't ever think it was, because now it's making me rely on the sensations that my body feels. Yes, ephemeral in the sense that like, if you're watching it, it's gonna go away, but because it won't be there anymore. But then also, like, the sensation doesn't leave your body. The memories don't leave your body. What imprints on you doesn't leave. So then, you know, it is and it isn't.
I think we are going to have to end it there. I could listen to you talk all night. And as you were talking, I came up with about, you know, 12 or 14 more questions. So we're going to have to do part two of this. But yeah, we are so far out of time. Thank you, Alice Jones. And let's do part two. Let's talk about that. And are you going to do the next dance in the time of coronavirus with Andy and Amanda?
I am doing Constellations on August 8th. Mm-hmm. So I'll be doing that. I know that Project Alchemy, we do a mentorship. So our mentorship performance is actually still happening in a very, very different way, which I'm super excited about. And that occurs in October. And then the company, we actually just got out of a brainstorm meeting today. We have a really, really cool project for St. Pete. That will be happening both in real time and virtually. And we're still working out like how it looks, but really excited about that. So
if anybody can do it, it's you. Alice Jones, thank you.
Thank you.
For joining us tonight. And we'll catch up with you again really soon, I know.
Yes.
Take care, my friend.
Yes, take care.
From stpetecatalyst.com.